First, let's talk about where this book came from. I know it's been a very personal journey for you. Tell us about Daniel O'Donnell, your former husband, and his experiences as a soldier in Vietnam.
I met Daniel about 6 months after he got back from Vietnam. And one of the things that he was an incredible storyteller. He was one of those people who could keep people laughing for hours. But he didn't tell me stories about Vietnam. And when I interviewed other women for Flashback, I heard the same complaint. Vietnam was simply off limits. I think in retrospect that they thought that they were protecting us, but really I think that they were protecting themselves. If we didn't know, we could be sanctuaries or safe places where they could pretend that Vietnam had never happened. We couldn't judge them, but then neither could we even try to understand. So the trade-off was intimacy. I knew he was sad, I knew he was in pain, but he never let me in. And when we hit rough spots in the marriage, he would just say he didn't want to live, and I would talk him out of it. And at the time, I thought it was very romantic to be loved so desperately. The last time, he didn't give me a chance, and by a freak accident, I found him in time to get him to the hospital, and he wasn't grateful. In fact, he was furious, and he screamed at me that he was going to do it again as soon as he got out. And that felt like extortion. I was in my early 20s. I had no idea how to save him. So I saved myself. I left. And then a couple of years later, I got a call from his sister saying that he'd been successful.
And how long did it take to put together the wartime experiences that he had with the afterwards, this person that he became?
It took me a very long time, and I think that the main reason for that was when Daniel came home from Vietnam, there was no such thing as PTSD. It was not a diagnostic category included in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. In the late 80s, the media began connecting suicides with Vietnam. I know I was hearing it, but I tuned it out for a long time. I think it was probably a lot less frightening to blame myself, to imagine that I actually might have had some control, that if I'd just been more loving or more aware, I could have prevented his death. I think it's very hard to accept that there's nothing that you can do, that it's, you know, it's not about you. But when I decided to write Flashback, it was because I had heard that there were a lot of Vietnam vets who'd killed themselves, and I wanted to hear from other widows how they had processed, who they blamed. And the more I talked to other women, the angrier I got. It turned out that we all still blamed ourselves for not having loved enough or noticed enough or intervened quickly enough. We all thought that we'd failed, that we were personally responsible. I want to push back against that, and writing this book was a chance to do that. I know that Daniel's death was a direct result of the war in Vietnam, and so were tens of thousands of other Vietnam veteran suicides. Their deaths were not our faults. We were war widows, whether or not their names are on the wall. And there was one other piece that I think was maybe not conscious when I started the book, and that is that I think I understood that I would find it easier to forgive myself if I practiced on other women, especially other women who, because they'd lived through similar experiences, were not likely to be accusing. From what I understand, that's very much the principle on which veteran rap groups work. People get to talk about what they've lived through in a situation that's not judgmental. I know it worked for all of the women that I talked to. We really needed each other to heal, and I think it worked for us.
Now, war has had this experience on humans for generations, and we're just starting to understand these things. You mentioned that the terminology just wasn't there, post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, what's the history of how we've treated our American soldiers who've been in combat? How have we treated them psychiatrically to sort of come back into society?
I think that the military has maybe the oldest and the most intractable myth in military culture that has survived for, you know, 200 years and longer, actually, but in this country. is that soldiers who fall apart in combat are weak or cowardly. And that's not something that is upheld with any kind of scientific studies or that anybody has seen. What people can see is that consistently combat-related stress is it's a democratic thing. It affects all kinds of people with all kinds of genetic and experiential histories. But the military has a vested interest in keeping that myth alive. I think that psychiatric injuries, because they're invisible, are harder to demonstrate. So the onus is on the individual first to admit that he or she is suffering and then to prove a service connection. And as long as soldiers believe that only the weak or the cowardly are vulnerable, they're going to be ashamed to ask for help, much less demand it. You know, it's a sweet and fitting thing to die for your country, maybe still has a certain romantic traction, but it's a sweet and fitting thing to be a psychiatric casualty or a suicide. It doesn't have the same compelling glamour. And so I think that what's happened is these soldiers have been essentially swift-boated. They've been made to feel afraid to talk about their illness. When the mental health advisory team that was sent to Iraq in 2003, because there were so many suicides happening in country, interviewed soldiers, they found that 50% of them were afraid to talk about anything that was any kind of psychiatric issues that they had because they were afraid that either they'd be ridiculed or they would be they'd lose their military careers would be affected. So it's actually interesting that, you know, the military could tell soldiers and their families up front what might happen to them, what the odds are, what to look for, what to do. But since Vietnam, anyway, soldiers have been increasingly treated as if they were disposable. And veterans have been treated like parasites or con men. And what's interesting about that is that, at least since Vietnam, it's the Pentagon and the VA that have been repeatedly shown to be illegally denying veterans the benefits they're entitled to. And then they accuse the veterans of trying to defraud the system. And they still get away with claiming they're supporting the troops. It's a disconnect.
And now today, as more and more of our troops are reservists and guard members, and the idea, even in all of the slick commercials that they put out for recruiting, is the idea of a citizen soldier, somebody who goes out and fights a war and then comes back home and works their job and coaches soccer and things like that. You know, it's amazing to me that our military, that so prides itself on the idea of the citizen soldier and using the guard and the reserve so much, haven't come up with a system to deal with this as part and parcel of being a soldier. As you mentioned, it seems to affect everybody across a broad range of life experience as well as age. So we have to assume that being in war will have these effects on one. And are there ways, if we acknowledge this, are there ways that soldiers could find help and that we could have citizen soldiers that do these jobs that are in the commercials?
You know, I think that one of the things that I've discovered since I've been doing the research for this book is that in 1990, there was a huge government study that was published, the National Vietnam Veterans Readjustment Study. And what that study found was that 30.9% of Vietnam veterans had a lifetime prevalence for PTSD. They used those same criteria and went back to study Korean War veterans and found that after almost 60 years, about 30% of them were still suffering from PTSD. And then in March of 2006, the Journal of the American Medical Association published a study that estimated that 1 in 3 Iraq War veterans would come home with PTSD. So there are 3 very different wars, but the same 30% who have experienced, or in the case of Iraq, will experience clinically serious stress reaction symptoms. And I do not mean to say that, to throw up our hands and say there's nothing that can be done. The sooner that soldiers are given the kinds of interventions that are available to them through the VA and through the vet centers, the drug and talk therapies that are available, and especially when those are combined with learned life coping techniques, people's lives can get much more manageable and much more feasible. But this is not an illness that anybody has come up with a cure for. And, you know, as of January of 2006, I think it was over a million troops that cycled through Iraq and Afghanistan. That's an awful lot of soldiers who are in immediate need of help. And when you combine that with the Vietnam War veterans who are coming back to the VA since this war started because the war has triggered their symptoms afresh or newly, it's going to be very, very expensive. But it is something that can be alleviated. But either way, you know, that's the conversation we should be having. It's a conversation that acknowledges what the true costs of war are and whether or not the vast quantities of blood and money we're investing are making us safer or richer or freer. And, you know, what are we going to do with these kids that need help?